Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the Ecom Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. I think a lot of us, when we've been hiring, we've been thinking about our company, you have to ask the question, and it rarely does it come up more poignantly when you're writing copy for that new job description, why would somebody come work for my company? Obviously, there's the money, right? That's a huge part. But apart from that, everyone offers money. So why would they come to your company versus all the thousands of alternatives out there? And Taylor Holiday, he's the owner of Common Thread Collective, very well known in the space for paid traffic. When he was tasked with this question and facing it, they came up with something pretty unique, and it was to help their employees to really pursue their dreams and desires in their life and be an advocate for them. And it sounds great on the surface, but it ended up kind of imploding and not going the way he had hoped. And he ended up having to really re-engineer and rebuild the company from the ground up to be customer-centric. And I think it's a fascinating story. I heard just the tip of the iceberg, something he shared in our forums, and I wanted to dive in and didn't disappoint. So we talk about what led to that initial design, how it went, what went wrong, how they re-engineered the company, some of the lessons they learned, and how he thinks about recruiting people now, how he thinks about culture now, how he thinks about evaluating employee performance now, which is really interesting. Love this discussion with Taylor. And it's a side of Taylor and his story that I haven't seen before. Again, he's a paid expert guy, lots of stuff out there, and an expert there. You should definitely be following him. But this is, I found especially interesting as well, with a touch at the end, talking a little bit about family, raising kids, some good stuff like that. Anyway, hope you enjoy this one. I really did, and we'll get into it. Taylor, like I mentioned at the top, you are probably one of, if not the most well-known, respected voices about paid traffic in the e-commerce space. You just had an exit, both of which are super interesting. We could do episodes on those. We're not going to touch those at all because there's a lot of other content about that. You're easy to find on all those things. Andrew Ferris, I think, just did a great episode with you about the exit, so we'll link up to that. But what I wanted to talk to you about, what I think is really fascinating, selfishly from my perspective, but I think it'll bleed over to a lot of other people, is the story of how you really transitioned the focus of your company from being very employee-focused to being very customer-focused. I'd love to dive in there. And maybe we can start with, I remember when I first got to know you and kind of Common Thread Collective came on my radar, one of the things that stood out to me was on your website. You went to the website and I noticed that right away. You had like, just tell me this focus on, tell me your dreams for the employees. And maybe you can talk a little bit about what the focus of Common Thread was, what that program was, and kind of pre-transition what Common Thread looked like from an employee perspective.
Yeah, there's a lot here. I'm going to try and be concise, but please interrupt me and seek clarity anywhere along the way. But early on when you start a company, you have this real challenge of answering the question of why anybody would want to work for you. Like, you can't pay people very much. Our office was crappy. Our client list wasn't very stable. And yet you want really smart people to come work for you, right? Like, that's like a problem to be solved for entrepreneurs. And I talk to early stage agencies all the time, and there's this challenge. So the answer we thought we could come up with was, we're like, all right, well, what if we could care more about the people, like their well-being, not the corporate well-being, but like their individual well-being more than everybody else? What if we were willing to go further in like making people feel cared for? Like, could we differentiate ourselves in a way that would be appealing to talent? And so the idea was, like, we started with my partner, Josh, would literally like just go sit with people. And the idea was like, what do you want out of your life? Like, what's your ambition? What's something that like, just you're allowed to say anything. And we know a lot of people, like, we'll just try and help you get it. And like, you know, and the classic joke is the very first person said, I want to start an agency someday. And it was like, oh, well, crap. Like, we didn't really think this through, you know, but we're like, we're committed to this idea. And so we helped him teach him how to file an LLC and do naming and branding and launch his own agency like that. And so it was like, well, we didn't really think this through too much. But, and out of that, we just started to build on top of the idea that the way that we'll appeal to talent to come here is by creating an investment in their individual future while they invest in our corporate benefit. Like, that was like the idea, is like, we own the equity, so you're going to help us build our dream. Could we help you build yours? And it was a mechanism for talent, and it just became very central to how CTC existed in the early days. Like, I mean, like, we're talking every month, the first Monday of every month was Dream Day, people announcing their dreams. We had multiple therapists and people on staff that would walk people through a program. Like, your KPIs were connected to your personal development around your dream. Like, it was like very, very deeply embedded in who we were in the first half of the era of CTC, for sure.
And I think a lot, I mean, that's such a hard question people struggle with. Like, one thing we have at Econ Fuel is we have an annual month-long sabbatical for all of our, you know, US full-time members, partially because I want to be able to run off and do cool adventures, and I want to be able to, you know, not feel like a hypocrite if my team can't do it, partially because I think it's good for recharge, partially because it's great for recruiting, right? But there's also downsides to that too, right? Like, you know, you lose a month, right? You've got ramp-up time, you know, it's there's some downsides as well. And so I feel like there's a good balance to strike there, but it's obviously, it sounds like you maybe went too far that way. Was that a book, which we'll get into? Maybe not, but I'm just reading between the lines here. Was there a book, or like, was that something you came up with on your own, or was there like a book or a program that put this on your radar?
So it was something we came up with on our own. We then later discovered a company that actually worked in, I may get this wrong, but worked in like waste management, where there was really high employee turnover. Janitorial services, I think is what it was. And they were trying to solve for high levels of employee churn. And so they created a similar program and had this like wild success out of it. And they wrote a book. And so it was like, oh, there's somebody else doing this too. And that's when we really were like, oh, okay. Because agency life is sort of subject to some of the same challenges, which is it's generally spoken about as a bridge profession. Like, you do it until you go on to do something else. It's like tour of duty almost. You come and it's high intense learning, and then you go off to the, you know, the comfortable brand side where you get to just, you know, whatever. You know, like, it's kind of how it's always perceived. It's like young people doing a ton of work, almost like a law firm style. And that's like how it's spoken about a lot. So there tends to be high levels of churn. And that's a problem when the quality of the service really is connected to the continuity of the people. You know, like, every time someone leaves, they take with them some amount of institutional knowledge and experience that then you have to replace, and you're sort of starting over and constantly closing that gap. And so we definitely were trying to solve for that problem as well. But, you know, candidly, like, in my own personal story, is that there was a lot mixed up in it for me from a religious standpoint, between like business purpose and meaning and life standpoint, and what I was wanting the organization to do and create and be, that I think was all woven into the fabric of what we were after with people. Like, it's hard to describe how deep we went down this rabbit hole. Like, I weren't talking about people like standing up in front of 100 of their peers, declaring their desire to fight addiction, to solve problems in their personal life, like very intimate, dramatic stuff in a corporate setting that was like really beautiful at the time and meaningful to people and impactful, but also like very confusing to then switch to, let's talk about Facebook ads for selling, birdhouses. Like, it's just like, what is happening here? It's a little of a stark contrast.
Yeah. Do you remember rereading that post you made in ECF about this? You had mentioned that you had to change the entire company mission and the company values during this process. Do you remember what some of or all of that mission and the values were before this transition and kind of this employee dream period?
Yeah. So the mission was to help entrepreneurs achieve their dreams. And we would define each of our employees as also their own entrepreneurs of their own lives. So it was like, we would literally track and measure the success of achieving our clients' dreams, our employees' dreams. So it's not like our clients were completely devoid of the story. But it was like weird. It was like kind of convoluted. And that was like, we would track. And I really believe that a company should define its success against its performance, against its mission, and against its stated mission. Like, that's, to me, still makes sense. And our stated mission was that. And so it became very like diligent about trying to say, are we doing the thing we say we're trying to do? And so we tracked it. We're really connected to it. And then the values, this is a whole nother thing, is that like, we started to introduce this core set of values that were a response to what we felt like people's experience of agency life was that we didn't want for them. One, and I'll give you an example, and this kind of connects to the idea you just talked about. One of them was respect the rest, okay? And because in an agency setting, sometimes the boundaries of when people can ask you for work are pretty blurry because your media spend could go wrong at any moment. Like, unfortunately, Facebook doesn't work on a 9-to-5 schedule. Your money is spending all the time. And so if it's 9:42 and there's a credit card that goes off, like someone expects you to fix that quickly. Like, and there's these expectations. And so it became very much this narrative that like we wanted to draw these boundaries and we called it respect the rest. We wanted to make sure people were using their paid time off. And we had, you know, goals around utilization rates of PTO and boundaries of time utilization and all these things that were value. And that was like one illustrative example where when I think about that, that's a value that's very much employee centric and not necessarily customer centric. Right now you could debate the merits of it. And what I've found, and I'd be interested in your policy, there's an interesting thing that happens when you have stated public values is that you tend to attract people who have a desire for that thing. It's kind of why you create values sometimes. And so if all of a sudden you have a bunch of people that are going, oh, they respect the rest here, what you get are tired people. And they've come out of some circumstance where they've been exhausted in some way, and you're offering them respite. You're offering them actually relief, which is nice and it's appealing. I'm not saying that people shouldn't have that, but it may not actually be the exact persona you need for the work that we're actually in. And so it's like we signed up to run a 24/7 liquor store, which is like the business that we're in. And then we're like, but we're not going to be available for it. It's just like we were in this weird contrast of the industry we had chosen and the values we wanted in a way that was like causing conflict. It was causing hardship.
CTC, the world's classiest 24/7 liquor store. That's such a great point. And the agency model in particular, you've got clients, and if something's going wrong with a spend campaign, you can lose, you know, tens of thousands, if not more money in a couple hours, an hour. So that's tough for you. I could see how that would be difficult. It's so challenging because I feel like this kind of mirrors the challenge you have as a leader. Like I've always looked at good leadership as walking this tightrope between understanding the needs of your team, understanding when there's been, you know, extenuating circumstances that made it impossible for them to hit them the goals, but also not to be a total pushover and hold them accountable at times.
Totally.
And it's such a hard challenge. And I think it's interesting looking at different frameworks. There's a company called LMNT. They make hydration packets.
Yeah, we've worked with them. Yeah. No.
Oh yeah. Cool. Okay. Yeah, they're based in Bozeman, actually. I was just looking. I love unboxing. I just ordered some of their stuff, got it yesterday, was doing the unboxing, and they had this little newsletter that I was reading about. And in there, it talked about the way they run their team. And they do this like 3-to-1 ratio sprint to rest ratio, where they have 3 weeks of every month where they push hard. You know, if they have to work overtime, they do it. They're really, it's a 3-week sprint to get something done. And then they have a week where they really recover. They have way more flexibility time. There's no project work. They kind of analyze and reflect on what went well. It's time to recharge and think, and then they start back over again. Anyway, only share that just because I think this is such a hard thing to figure out. Like obviously it didn't work on the dream side for you, especially for your business model. But at the same time too, if you just push people, you know, nonstop, and even if your stated values are, we're just going to crush it. We're going to make absolute top dollar working 80, 90, 100 hours a week. Like that's investment banking. I was a part of that world for a while. Most people don't last investment banking. And the ones that do usually, you know, their lifespan, I don't have numbers on it. I'm guessing at least their hairspan and hairline significantly shrinks, if not their lifespan, right?
Yeah.
So it's such a hard thing to solve for.
What I've found is that there's a couple of things. One is you have to understand the rules of the game that are beyond you. And I really think that a for-profit enterprise actually is like has a predefined set of rules and expectations. And so it's like if I went to play basketball and I went in and I was like, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to like every time you catch the ball, you get to do a cartwheel. And it's like, well, hold on, time out. Like that's not actually, there's a game here and that's not this game. You could play that game. You could go make a new one if you want. But if you signed up to create a for-profit enterprise, you've actually agreed that the rule and the measurement of success is profit. Like that's the definition of success. And if you try and change the rules, you've actually tried to play a different game. And so I look back and go like, I tried to create a nonprofit or purpose-driven entity or maybe even a church. I don't know. But it certainly wasn't. So I signed up for the wrong game for the thing that I was constructing. And so I think that's one thing I've tried to acknowledge more is that there are actually predefined sets of obligations and rules related to the kind of thing you create that you have to be conscious of. So that is the one thing that I would say. The other thing I would say to this point is that I actually believe that there are all kinds of people that like all kinds of different amounts of effort and work in their life. And I probably used to have more of an opinion on one being right or wrong. I far less do now. If someone wants to work in 3 week sprints and rest for a week, then I say, cool, go work at Element. Freaking fantastic. But on the spectrum from like David Goggins to the guy who does nothing all day, there's humans all across that spectrum. And there are some that actually love client work and love the idea of being perpetually in their work. It's satisfying to them. And so you can source for everything. The key is to be honest about who you are and what you're after, and then allowing people to choose into that. When you create conflict is when you present to be one thing, but the reality is the opposite. Then you end up in this thing where people are like, wait a second, you said it was going to be respect the rest, and I'm getting a call at 9 o'clock. What's going on here? You know? So I think I've tried to just get way more honest about what is the industry we've chosen? What is the realities of it? What are we after as an organization? And to create a little bit more clarity across the connection between the goal of the enterprise, what is the expectation of the work? And what I found is that people are actually happier. It's actually simpler than it was when we were trying to deeply serve all of these individual needs and interests that were at conflict with our work.
So where did you start to see this, you know, what were some of the signs, early signs that, hey, maybe this isn't working? Completely leaning into trying to help our employees achieve all their dreams isn't you know, causing some existential issues here. What were some of those signs?
One was the amount of time, energy, and resource that was going into this program was intense. Like, and so we were literally like taking hours and hours of people's weeks and money and resource into these programs and processes. And it wasn't just TMYD. We also had a lot of deeply woven initiatives around DEI and things in that era, like that were a part of what we tried to go after, all again centered on the individual experience of the people inside of the organization and what we wanted for them in their life. And all I can say with a level of integrity that I feel good about, that at the time we believed it was the right thing to do in every case, and we're attempting to serve people to the best of our known ability. We failed at a lot of things. But it was just sucking up literal time and resource. So that was one thing, is that like we had a problem of the availability of the people and the money and the utilization of it. The second was that the employees weren't actually satisfied. Is that it wasn't leading to this experience of people that they were like, I feel really happy. It was actually, what I find is that it's a bit like if you start with the entitlements that you are going to get when you participate in it, what you're inviting people to always look at is this balance sheet of what they're receiving from the organization. And is it at the right level for what I want or what I expected? And that's like a really hard thing to consistently meet everybody's individual desire of what their expectation of what they're getting is. And so that became like this thing where you're like, you're actually more dissatisfied the more I give you. It's like this weird thing that it doesn't actually satisfy in the way that maybe you'd think endless benefits would, is that eventually it's just like, what's the next benefit? And the effect of them like wears off really quickly. And deeper purpose, I have found, is actually when you ask people to contribute, is that when we went from here's all the things that we'll give you to here's what we need from you actually. We actually need you to give us things. We need you to contribute to this place. That actually was way more meaningful than all the things I could give them, was for them to feel like they were contributing and actually an effective at their work as a professional. And so that was like a big switch, that it was like, it was an endless hole of trying to offer benefits and it like didn't satisfy. And so I think that was the other thing that was experienced, is that there was just so much money, resource, time going into this, and it wasn't yielding satisfied, happy, high performing people. And so it was like, this isn't worth it. And so that was a bit of the experience.
Interesting. One thing I traditionally ask when I do, like, you know, we do quarterly reviews or whatever it is we've got all the business goals for each team member. And I also ask people to share, if they want to, personal goals. Because from my perspective, I, you know, did not go anywhere near as close as you did with the CTC and the, you know, share your dreams initiative. But I love knowing, hey, what's important to you? What are you trying to achieve outside of your work? Is there any way I can help out with that? You know, can I check in with that? And I think some people have appreciated it. Other people have been like, in very polite language, no, I'm not going to share my personal goals with you. Bugger off. This is business, right? And so, you know, in a polite way. So, but the other thing that's interesting is like, I will probably keep doing that to some extent, but one of the biggest, you know, we all have these frameworks, either explicit or subconscious, that we use to run our life. And one of the frameworks that I have really internalized over the last 2 years was that I am not going to try to help someone do something unless I have a decent degree of conviction that they want to do it themselves. They're the one driving that initiative. Because there's been too many times where I'm like, hey, you need to do this either, you know, not even as much in business. I think this manifests itself more in my personal life, just seeing other people, hey, this would be good. Can I help you do this? And it wasn't their idea. They didn't want to do it. And I would, it's like pushing a rope. And I just, so anyway, that's just something that I have deeply internalized in my life for operating, and will probably carry over into business a little bit too.
The other thing I would say is that, like, as a company and me personally, like, I'm not actually as helpful in some of these areas as I thought I was. Like, turns out I'm not a therapist. Turns out I don't actually have great relationship advice, or turns out I can't really help you scuba dive that well. Like, so I tried to, like, I think I circled thinking I was, like, way more important than I was, in all honesty, looking back on it. Like, I shouldn't have actually dabbled in parts of people's lives that we weren't equipped to support them in. Like, it's not actually helpful. It's actually can be really harmful. And there's whole organization. It's kind of like coaching. Like, I thought I was a coach and you should make me a coach, but I wasn't a coach. I didn't know anything about coaching. And so I wasn't in a position to do that effectively. And so I think some of these things fell into that arena as well, where what we were was a marketing agency and we were good at that. That doesn't then give us license to think that we're going to be effective at designing your, like your marital relationship feedback loops. Like that's like not a thing that we should participate in, you know? And that's like, I'm being, you know, a little hyperbolic. It's not like we were doing a lot of that, but the point is just with the best of intentions, like wanted things for people, kind of like you do. It sounds like you do, like you care about them as humans. Like, and, but what I found is just that my care for you doesn't then invite me into participation in all factors of your life. Like, and so I actually started giving people more space to be adults in the authority of their own life and saying, here's what I need from you here. Here's the mutual exchange we have around this professional outcome we're desiring to create. And it actually made, it turned the drama way down, and it made the task at hand more simple, and it allowed us to focus on the work. And people, whatever they were doing on the outside of that is like, I didn't need their whole self here. Like, I just didn't. And they didn't need to bring it. Like, it's not to say that there wasn't space if someone had a problem or wanted to talk, but that wasn't the point of what we were here to do. And so I think it's made it a lot simpler, and it's allowed the work to emerge and become central in a way that's been really effective for the stated business purpose, which is growing the bottom line. And we're doing that much more effectively.
Yeah. So how did that transition look? I mean, you're in this place. I don't know if you had like a, you know, this kind of eureka moment, and then that was very discreet, or if it was, I'm guessing it was probably more gradual. But what did that transition look like in terms of talking with the team, rolling new things out, staff, you know, hiring new people, letting people go? There's a lot there.
So it was actually fairly acute. And so underpinning this, I don't want to, sometimes it feels like an oversimplification of everything that happened for me to put these into like pithy little statements. But because underpinning all of this was COVID, right? Where we went from a very geocentric in-office culture to suddenly fully remote, underpinning a massive growth rate in e-commerce that just blew up. And so all of a sudden, we went from 60 people to 180 people really fast. So at one point, I think like 70% of the people at CTC hadn't been in CTC for less than a year.
Wow.
And so like when you think about, that's like a very dramatic cultural change that like is gonna change who you are no matter what. Not to mention like I didn't meet half those people in person ever. like, and so it was just really hard to create continuity of anything at that moment. And then all of a sudden it's just as fast as it went up, it stopped. The summer of 2022, like it just all stopped. Retail opened back up. The excess capital disappeared. Demand just fell off a cliff. And we went through that was like, oh, we're gonna go broke. Like we can't continue on this path. And so that was a forcing function for the evaluation of every idea. So everything got put on the table, from the cultural initiatives to the way we priced our business to the services we were in, everything. And we had to lay off 100 people over the course of 3 months. That changed everything. And then we went into 2023 going, okay, we have to really recreate who we are from the ground up. New mission, new values, new statements, new cultural identity. And that was a big project. And so at that point, I hired Dane, who's now our VP of what we call employee performance and development. So we don't have HR anymore under the formal title. And we really sort of reimagined what we wanted out of this work relationship with people and how we would assess it and present it. And that was the beginning of what was novel. So it was a very acute moment that demanded change, whether we wanted it or not. And so that gave us the necessary inflection to start to evaluate a lot of these ideas.
Hey, Andrew here with a quick sidebar. I want to introduce you to Daniel, the owner of dayspringpens.com, where they sell, not shockingly, pens and pen accessories. Daniel's an incredibly kind and gracious guy, was hugely helpful in terms of helping people with the lay of the land at our recent, or not so recent, Norfolk event for ECF Live. But here's what he had to say about his experience with E-commerce Fuel, our private embedded community for 7- and 8-figure owners.
At E-commerce Fuel, I think the thing that brings the most value is just having so many engaged entrepreneurs who are asking questions, helping one another, sharing their wisdom and expertise on different areas that help me as a business owner sort through all the noise. So there are a ton of service providers, there are a ton of solutions, there are a ton of plugins and people that want to charge a subscription fee or help consult in the business. But having kind of a central repository of people who have nothing to gain by helping, that are just kind of thoughtfully engaged in becoming expert and sharing their wisdom with others is by far the most valuable thing. And that carries across to the live events as well as the forum online. It's just something that is very hard to replicate in any other professional setting, in my opinion.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7- or 8-figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show.
And so you're going through that. What, you laid off a lot of people. Were there people, obviously the people that you laid off would, you know, but from a business perspective made a lot of sense. Of the remaining team, did you sit them down once you had crafted all this, kind of had a new true North Star? And maybe even before we talk about what you do with the team, what did that new mission and values look like? We talked about the old ones a little bit. What did the new ones look like?
Yeah, so there's a couple questions. So yeah, we sat and talked to people a lot. And what I would say is that in reality, what we ended up with was a lot of the group of people that existed before COVID that were the only ones that had enough trust, I think, to continue with us through that moment and to recognize that what we had gone through was so novel and like really truly a black swan event that, and we had enough relational equity for them to continue to trust us after the fact. And so that's a lot of on the human side. And then on the mission and value side, we wanted to say like, what would it look like to put the customer at the center of it? And I think that was a big thing. We had felt we had become very like selfish. And you know that like sort of like, there's just like a general wisdom piece or trope or however you want to frame it, that like the more you think about yourself, the more depressed you become. Like
that, yeah, like it's true. Yeah.
That had sort of become us, is that we are constantly like introspecting surveys. How are we doing? How are you as employees feeling? Like looking at ourselves constantly in this way. And so it was like, well, let's just re-aim. Who's writing us the checks? Like whose money are we taking in the name of service? And what if we just like went to a focus on them? And so that was like this big thing where we launched what we called CTC like 2.0, redefined all the mission, vision, and values around building the next generation of legendary brands and the people who will lead them. And so it was still like, there was still this nod to this idea that CTC was going to be a developmental place where people were learning and growing and becoming, but it was first and foremost about building the next generation of legendary brands, like helping people become, because a lot of the market that we served was sort of like 10 to 30 million. They weren't, the way we would talk about it is like, they're not the people lining the streets of Soho today, but they will be in 20 years. Like that next class of brands that are going to become the Nikes of tomorrow, you know, are who we serve today. And we had seen some of that play out. And so there was a whole story around that. We redefined every value, all the way that we did everything at CTC. And so it was like this complete rebrand for us. It was needed. We needed a new vision. People needed that at that moment because we had seen the previous one kind of hit the skids a little. So it was time for a new one for sure.
And you don't need to go through all of them, but what were one or two of those visions that were kind of representative of being more client focused?
So one of the big things that Dane, our VP of Employee Development and Performance, talked about is this idea of a standards-based culture. So you move from sort of this more subjective idea to that this is less about you as a person and your individual capacity. It's more that there's a standard for everyone about the level that we deliver it. And that is an objective externality that like we just don't compromise. And so your expectation is that whatever's happening, you have to achieve, meet the standard. And so the first value became, we set the standard. And I can read it like, we seek to become the definition of best in class. Our research, methodology, customer experience, and employee talent is referenced as the bar that agencies aspire to emulate and brands lean on as the foundation for their growth. We provide the research referenced in industry reports, the data informing board meetings, and the strategies at the center of industry conversations. We earn trust with clients and colleagues through preparation, focus, resilience, dependability, and accountability. So that's like value one. Number two is we are driven to increase value. We exist to turn marketing strategies into financial outcomes. We leverage our expertise, technology, and network while accounting for trends, economic conditions to deliver profitable growth to our customers. We focus on compounding strategies that set trajectory for sustained long-term results. We manage resources efficiently for client satisfaction and our own firm's growth. So this is an idea. It's really like easy to see how like now when I talk to an employee about their own compensation or anything else, it's just very simple to frame it back to like, well, let's talk about how much money you make for the company. Like everything we do is a relationship between cost and value created. From the employee work to the client work to everything is an assessment through that lens. And so that became the second really big point. And then the third is that we create an environment of excellence. We foster an environment for exceptional people to excel. We embrace diversity of thought by holding all ideas to rigorous standard of critique and validation. We embrace the responsibility to be both educators and learners at all times. We hold the legacy of the collective in high regard and seek to leave CTC better than we found it. We take our work seriously. And that is an idea invites like a very different set of people that like what, how they care about the quality of their professional output. And that really matters. And then we talk a lot about this idea of like putting a brick into the CTC structure where when you come here, the expectation is that you've contributed and left your mark to make it better than it was when you got here. And so again, this is, it's this very like, what are you contributing? Not what are you getting? There is a mutual exchange. When you create value, you receive value. We want that to be true. But you're here to help us build. And that it just, I think, invited like people with an enthusiasm for that kind of idea. So those are the new sets.
How much an employee costs versus how much they bring into the company. And obviously as an owner, you're thinking about that. Is that something you talk very, candidly with when you're talking with employees in terms of that P&L? Is that on the table? You just straight up?
So our level of transparency financially, I think would shock a lot of people. Like we have a table that is the gross margin managed by every single person in the company in terms of client value. And so you can see that list. We have our entire P&L. We have a live view of our own P&L. We call it the sandbox that every manager and above has access to at all times. You can see every input of cost in every part of the organization, every piece of revenue. In the company meetings, we present our performance against bottom line expectation. We have something called the Key Employee Index, where we actually grade and rank every employee in every role based on a series of set criteria. And at first, this is like a really hard idea. But what I found was that these were all the things that we were saying anyways, behind closed doors, behind people's perspective. And now we just want people to know that like you are being assessed on your performance. You are being assessed on your value creation. We want you to have clarity on how you're doing and how you're performing against it. And we're all after the same goal. We're all here to make more money. And so if you help us more money, you'll make more money. And I've found that like this is maybe the most cynical thing that I've discovered along the way, but I just think at the end of the day, this is a game about money and that most people are motivated most clearly and simply by financial incentive. And it's the easiest way to organize behavior collectively with clarity.
That Key Employee Index, is that public for everyone in the company to see?
So every manager has it for their people and it's accessible by request. So if you'd like to know where you stand, you're allowed to request and access it, and every manager has it for their people. And part of what we're trying to do is that whether you like it or not, you rank people. And the way you rank people is by the money you pay them. You could build a list of how much you pay every person, and that's a ranked list of value that you've assigned. And what we just want to make sure is that that list matches the impact list. And that when those things are incongruent, that we assess and try and reconcile those incongruences. And so I think that is what I've found to be the best attempt at objectivity around this idea. And we have gone down many lanes on this idea of like comp and different thing. But, and there's questions that are, there's a combination of objectivity in this where we, your performance against your KPIs historically over time, that sort of thing. And then there's also like subjective questions about your drama tax, we call it. Like how much are you taking up too much energy, too little energy, or just right? There's something we call like the rule of five, which is this idea of, are you a detractor? Are you neutral? Or are you a positive contributor? And like, we're always trying to see like, who are the people that are on the fence, who are the detractors, and who are positively contributing. So we build out this attempted profile of understanding where the keys people are in the organization and make sure that we are giving them opportunity for growth and benefit and participating financially in success to the benefit of the organization.
That's amazing. Last question on the comp side and the incentive side. Obviously, the whole culture has shifted towards performance and accountability, and we're delivering value to our clients. How do you tie that in with rewarding people financially? I think one of the hardest things I have found, and granted, we're in very different business models. On the agency side, you know, you can pretty much say, hey, here's how much we spent, here was our return. There's much more of a quantitative result you can get, even if it's imperfect. In community sometimes, I mean, that's one of the hardest things that I was actually thinking about this walking around this morning with some coffee and outside was like, how do I come up with better, you know, how do I evaluate people when so many of the inputs that we put in are soft, they're relational, they, you know, you can't tap into everyone's neurojack, you know, brain and figure out how this is all impacted. You're building something long-term with people. Anyway, but you still have some of those problems. So when you think about compensating people, you have the salary, but for that performance-based, how do you measure that? What's that formula look like, or just even ballpark?
Yeah. So I do think that we have one of the easier business models to do it, because fundamentally what we're selling is people's time. And so it's very easy for me to go, person A manages X dollars of business that produces Y margin against, you know, Z cost. Like that, so it's probably way simpler for me than most, like a law firm in that sense. Like that was really the modality that started to make a lot of sense to me, is that the best lawyers bill the most money for the company. It's like pretty straightforward. You get the best clients to pay you the most money, they stay the longest, and you make the most money. It's like actually very simple. And so a couple of the things that we did is we just went like, everybody goes back to work. You all bill now. And so there's no management layer at CTC. Like everybody bills client work, because that's the easiest path to solve that problem, Andrew, is that I think that there is so much ambiguity for most organizations, and there is no way to answer the question clearly. Like, and it makes it really hard. Like, so I don't have an answer to the ambiguous roles. And I even tell our HR leader, so Dane, let's talk about employee development. It's the hardest role to me to do this. But you know what Dane's actually done? He bills client work. He actually has gone out and serviced customers around some of these ideas. That's like, that makes it easier. And then he's gotten really good at understanding like, okay, what's our relationship between staffing versus revenue? And he's working really hard to try and find the answer. But his job is actually the hardest. He has to work harder than everybody else to bring evidence to that idea. And part of that's just like the roles that you choose to participate in at CTC relative to your desire for compensation increase is that it's going to be simplest if you can connect it directly to the way the company makes money. So I'll give you another example. We had an employee recently, she's sitting across from me here, who the other easiest way to justify individual value is to go, there was no revenue line item for the service that didn't exist. I went and created it. It's a net new thing, and I went and sold it to all the customers. And now here's this incremental line item of revenue for CTC that didn't exist before that. I'll assign you lots of value and money to that. If you say you want to take a portion of the paid media revenue, which is like a decade of CTC history that has gone into creating it, like it's a lot more ambiguous whether that was you or not. You know, like,
right.
But creator content didn't exist before Adrian launched creator content. And now I can look at the revenue and go, oh, that's easy. Global Accelerator at CTC didn't exist before Joy created it. So Joy's claim to that money is much more obvious to me. It's easy to draw that causal connection. So this is the thing I try and educate employees on all the time, because I want them to make more money. And so I just go like, hey, let me teach you how I see value and how to assign it to yourself so that you could go do it in the way that's mutually beneficial to both of us. Like where CTC's bottom line grows and your bottom line grows. Like that's the best outcome. So we're always really trying to hone in on those areas as obviously and clearly as we can.
Yeah. And it's so interesting to hear you talk about this, because having had conversations with you, like I remember at one ECF Live, we sat down at one of the speakers' dinners and talked about this. And it came through clearly. It came through obviously clearly if people haven't picked up on it, on V1.0 of CTC, like your care and concern for your team. Like knowing you and your values, you don't just care about money. Right? Like it's not like you're saying this is the end all be all of life or anything, but all you're saying is it's the most effective way, at least that you found in your business, to organize how do you structure incentives and success. So it's really interesting to see that whole arc of how you've come. What are the areas that you still think through, okay, there isn't a monetary, this is hard to measure monetarily, or hey, maybe we still should care about or think about or focus on team or things outside of work. Are there any development areas or performance ways outside of money that you, that I think maybe I'm maybe a clearer way to say it, is there, what parts, if any, of the old CTC model have survived from an incentive and a culture standpoint that you think still are worth keeping even in this kind of new focused culture?
Oh, I think that CTC has always been a place where we care a lot and people will be developed and grow a lot as a high learning and educational environment for people who participate in it. That's always been true. And I think that remains true. That's still very important. And one of the benefits that people appreciate about being here, part of that is like you have access to lots of information. There's other smart people around you. And so you'll sort of have this MBA type experience of learning. And that remains important to us. I don't think that that has changed. And it's a value that we can very quickly see who is curious about their own personal development. And so I think that there's this, we, as an example, we have a thing, we used to look at, you know, PIPs, the idea of like a performance improvement plan, mm-hmm. right? So it tends to be like, that's like an introduction when things go wrong, is you like put someone on a performance improvement plan. And like, I actually probably am a bigger supporter of that idea than maybe some people who see it as just like a way to fire people. I don't really believe that. I really think you can improve people. But what we wanted to do is like, well, what about people on the other side? It's actually, I think so often an organization's resource and energy goes into trying to make bad okay versus trying to make good great. And so one of the big things we wanted to reallocate was like, what if we took a lot of more of the employee, like HR style resource, and we put it to the good people, not to the people that were struggling. And so we created this thing called VIPs, which are voluntary improvement plans, which are people who put their hands up and go, I'm at level A, I'd like to get to level B. I'm willing to put in more time and effort towards becoming that if you equip me with resource. And so that is something that is an example we introduced to say, you've sort of put your hand up and declared, I want to learn skill A, B, or C, and I'm actually willing to go above and beyond trying it. We'd rather take the organizational energy and give it to that person than the person who's like a detractor and is out of, like, not that interested in improving, and try and make them want it. Like, to your point earlier about giving people what they want to do. So I think that is an idea of like a voluntary improvement plan still matches an individual's ambition for themselves in the way that TMYD might have, but it's all focused on their job. And I'd say that's just the narrowing of the resources. Like, we're going to help you improve professionally. If you put your hand up and say you want to play the flute, we'll say, go talk to somebody who teaches the flute. Whereas before we would have like hired you a flute instructor. And so I think that's maybe the difference a little bit.
I will say one thing that I think is a huge testament to what you've built in V1 and V2 is the number of people in the e-commerce space that I know that have become leaders and thought leaders and doing amazing things that came out of CTC originally is more than any other company or agency that I can point to by a factor of, you know, by multiple factors. So I think that's a pretty, your alumni.
And I agree. And I used to wear that like a badge of honor, but now actually what I think it is, Andrew, is it's leadership failure. What I mean by that, let me explain, is that I didn't create circumstance for people that talented with that much ambition to stay here. I actually lost them. And in part because like they went to better opportunities that could pay them more money and their ceiling was higher. But that to me is sometimes all the time, your job as a leader is to figure out how to create the opportunity for the most talented people to make more money inside of your thing than anywhere else. And that was the big mistake that I made, is that, and a lot of it has to do with like equity allocations and the things, the way you incentivize people. Like one of the things that transformed our culture too was that we had the ESOP, and there's a whole thing about that. We haven't even touched on it, that it's less impactful as a mechanism than maybe I had hoped initially. But we also had another moment where we had a couple of partners leave, and we did a buyback of their shares, and we invited employees, some of our key group of leaders, to write checks to purchase those shares. And we had 14 employees write checks, good sized checks, to acquire equity. That changed everything about their behavior. That created continuity and commitment because we actually gave them both things that equity represents, risk and reward. And when they're actually both really important levers, stick and carrot. They're both like, you need the fear of loss and you need the opportunity of reward, both to appropriately motivate people. And so when that was actually the thing that I could have done to keep all of those people that left here, because then I could have created the monetary outcome that would have been consistent with their market potential. The reality is the Shireens and the Andrews and the Nicks and all the people, the reason they left is because someone paid them 50% more money, or they earned a lot more money somewhere else. Like, that's just the fact. not because they didn't love us, not because they didn't appreciate their appearance, it's because we couldn't meet their market potential. That was a big lesson for me that like, I'm not going to let that happen again and rock around telling everybody how cool it is that Luke or Tony or Adrian left. Like that doesn't actually is like, I failed as a leader. I lost key talent. And that's been a big change too, is that like, I don't actually want people to leave anymore. I actually want them to help us crush it here. And if you're smart and I've developed you here and you've become better, why would I want somebody else to reap the benefit of that? But it's my job to make sure I can match your earning potential in the market, because that's what fair market value represents and I have to meet it. And so I think that's another big area that I just like changed a lot of the way I thought about it. And I think the other one was like insecurity. And it's just the story you make up when important people leave. It's like, well, look how cool it was that they worked here. And it's like, well, sort of, but really they left you. And that's honestly what happened.
No, I appreciate it. That's a honest, helpful take. I want to close with a question that's far more important than talking about building companies, developing people at your work, which is kids. You've got three kids. You got two boys that are 11. You've got a daughter that's 7 or 8. How are you thinking about, I think about raising them? That's a big question, but like, what are some of the things you're trying to do with them? What are the activities you're trying to invest, or behaviors you're trying to encourage, or conversations you're having? Or again, huge open-ended question, but as you think about raising kids, what are your priorities there? What are the things that you're really trying to emphasize?
I listened to this guy that was like talking about reimagining schools. I'm gonna butcher the name of the thing that he created, but it was like, you know, some educator talking about new modalities of school. And what he talked about was like that the fundamental goal of education should be to prepare kids to be autonomous, contributing adults in a way that is productive. And I think a lot about parenting as that is that at some point they're going to leave me, that, and I want them to be okay when they do. And I want them to be thriving when they do. And so that's actually my job. And I can get pretty selfish and want things about my experience with them for sure. That's in there. And I want to have awesome vacations and joy, and I want them to hug me and need me. And those things matter for sure. But at the end of the day, I want them to be okay when they're an adult. And the other thing is that I think Nassim Taleb, I believe, has this like that the ultimate, or maybe this is, what's the other philosopher guy on Twitter that's all the time? Anyways, I'll
forget. Naval?
Naval, no, yes. Thank you. Yeah. You knew exactly what I was talking about. So Naval talks about that the ultimate side of intelligence is the only thing that actually matters in evaluating someone's intelligence is, can they get what they want out of life? And I think that that is in some way also my job to help them, which requires a process of getting clarity. Like, what is it like to sort through your own desires and to decide? So as a good example, like one of my sons right now is deciding, do I want to keep playing soccer? And like, my job is to help him consider the inputs to that decision and to think through, for the sake of all the future your decisions you're going to have to make about, do I want X, Y, or Z? What does it look like to take a decision like that and build a criteria for evaluating it? How trustworthy are your emotions on a daily basis? What are the other facts that contribute? What are things that make you feel really happy or sad over time? Where do you feel immensely rewarded? Where do you feel challenged? Like, and to build the spectrum of things to make those choices so that as he gets to later in life, he can get the things that he wants. And that those are the sort of the trellis I'm trying to construct around their life, is the ability to be autonomous adults and contribute to society, and then to be intelligent enough to get what they want out of life, I guess would be my simple answers.
Yeah. Thanks for fielding. That's a big question to just throw out you there at the end after, you know, interrogating you for 45 minutes. One thing I think that's also cool too, that I don't know if this is a regular thing, but I feel like on more than one occasion I've seen you take, obviously you're a huge baseball fan. I think your boys both play baseball. I don't know if your daughter is a baseball or a softball fan or not, but it seems like you have done a really good job of taking them out for really cool experiences. Like I remember a couple amazing games you've taken them to.
Yeah, the Freddie Freeman game one of the World Series. We got to be there. That was amazing. That was probably my peak life moment, maybe.
Peak life moment. But even apart from that, I remember that one, but there was other ones. And I've always thought, you know, grew up in Idaho, lived most of my life in Idaho or Montana, spent a period of time in Arizona, which was nice because we had the Diamondbacks kind of close. But that was a short window and still far. Anyway, sports, people can waste their life on sports in certain regards, and where it becomes this, you know, idol that that's all they spend their weekends doing and nothing else matters and et cetera, et cetera. But I also think I've always been a little jealous and thought it's very cool when you have a hometown team like the Dodgers that you love, that you can bring your family into. And it creates this really cool, rich tradition that can span generations. Because a lot of times it's not necessarily about the sports. Like if I had to bet, your kids love baseball, but when they go to a Dodgers game, when they're 20 or 30 or 40 with their kids. The baseball will be a part of it, but a huge part of it will be the memories, the nostalgia, the relationship with their dad. And that's you know, when they watch it on TV, at home with barbecue, like it's just such a cool thing to be able to incorporate in a world where so much of like a lot of tradition and rites of passage have been lost. I think it's a really cool thing that remains. And I think you've done a really good job of that.
It's funny, Andrew, like this is, kids did a project at school where they were talking about like family traditions and heritage. And the reality is like, we don't have a lot. My parents are divorced. My dad's parents were divorced. We don't have a long lineage of like historical traditions. And it was like literally hard to fill out a school project about family traditions. And that was like, I grieved that. I thought a lot about that. And so I think we've tried to start to think about what are things that I could give them that become, what I found is that it's like helpful structure for parenting. It's like, how do you be a dad? Well, I don't know. Let me think about some ways that I tried to illustrate to you someday, like what it felt like to care for you and to provide experience and to think about those imperfectly, entirely imperfectly. But as an example, like when I think about symbols and other things that go into that is like, so at that game, we caught a foul ball. So that ball's like in a safe. And like, if I left it out, my kids would give it to the dog and it'd be chewed up and it'd be gone. But like, when my sons have a son, I'm gonna give them that. And it's going to be like this indication of like, dude, it almost makes me emotional. Like, I want you to know, like, this meant so much to me. Like, and so seek these out for yourself. Go find them and create these moments because it will mean so much to you. So supports do illustrate that. They're just these like shared, deeply, like when Freddie Freeman hit that home run, the picture I have of like my kids hugging the random stranger next to them in their head and experiencing like the purest elation that life has to offer is like, I'll carry it forever. Like it can't be taken away in like this way that's really deeply important. So yeah, do I care that much about the Dodgers? I don't know, whatever. They're cool. I like it. But that for my sons to be in that space together was just like, man, wow, so cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. You got a Sandlot V2.0 game or a sequel queuing up with exactly. this baseball in the safe.
I totally do.
Oh man. Well, Taylor, so always love talking. Thank you for sharing all this, man, for being as candid as you were about, you know, kind of the failures, the successes, the personal side of things. You obviously, if people haven't figured it out yet, run Common Thread Collective. And man, I can think of few better testimonials than an entire case study on how you pivoted the whole business to focus on customers. Give people a quick sense. Obviously, you help people scale their business with paid traffic on Meta and mostly Meta, but I get potentially other places. Give people a quick idea of who you're a great fit for and who you can help if they're curious.
Yeah, so we focus on helping mid, let's call it 8-figure and above consumer product e-commerce brands grow predictably and profitably. That's what we're here to help you do by bringing clarity to what it means to be profitable and then the ability to make really great decisions about how to go. And we can't do it on our own. It's going to be in partnership with you and the amazing team that you inevitably have and the plans and products you're developing. But we like to do it with discipline and rigor and really care about the money that you're spending. And we'd love to chat if that's helpful. And if I could just say last thing, Andrew, because one of the things I hate about, and even I feel, if I'm honest, like I feel kind of like stupid because I've changed my mind so many times that the certainty with which I express something, I don't think always takes into account the reality that I could be totally wrong about everything that I'm saying. And that what I would encourage people more than anything about listening to me or anyone else is that one of the things I feel most proud of though, all along the way, is that in each moment, I acted consistent with my belief. And that's kind of integrity is like whatever you believe to be true about how you should care for your company or the people or the customers, like if you can be as present in that, in the certain reality, you're allowed to change your mind. You're in control of the company. You can switch. Those are the things that I would encourage you. And just like be as fully present in that belief as you can. And at the end of it, even when you're wrong, you'll feel okay. Like you'll feel proud of the way you acted. And I think that's like actually the best thing I could offer is less than my specific journey or the specific ways we do it is that whatever you believe presently, as consistent your behavior and belief can be, then at the end of it, as you reflect, you'll feel good about it.
Yeah. None of us get out of here alive without making a bunch of mistakes along the way. It's the first correction, I think, that counts. So if you're not following Taylor on Twitter, check him out. He's a great follow. He's always posting tons of stuff about, especially in the paid world. Probably the best follow on Twitter, in my opinion. Taylor, thank you so much, man. Always love the talks and appreciate everything and look forward to next time. Thank you, my friend.
Yeah, buddy. Good to see you, sir.
If you're an entrepreneur who wants to connect with other experienced owners, who are working to build a financially vibrant business alongside a rich, meaningful life, head on over to ecommercefuel.com to learn more and connect with 1,000 entrepreneurs just like you. Work hard, adventure often, and forge what matters. Look forward to seeing you again next Friday.